Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Surviving Decapitation. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. So, we have a bit of a different tone to tonight's episode, guys. I wanted to release this short little episode before we get into a new deep dive series that we've been working on. And I hope you all enjoy. Fun fact, the average human head weighs around 11 pounds, or 5 kilograms. There is a myth that it weighs 8 pounds, but you can thank Cameron Crowe for that misconception. But that aside, an adult human head actually weighs more than most newborn babies. And all of that is balanced on just 7 vertebrae in your neck, and supported by around 20 muscles. These muscles are responsible for moving your head around and keeping that weight firmly in place. But you didn't tune into this episode to listen to some fun facts, did you? You want to know how the hell you can survive someone lopping your head off. Well, firstly, let's do the mathematics. The velocity of an 11-pound head dropping, whilst dependent on distance, we do know that acceleration due to gravitational pull and distance fallen can be surmised as around 32 feet per second, or 9.8 meters a second, if falling 2 to 3 feet. So with that in mind, we can estimate that the head would hit the ground with a force of roughly 214.1 joules, which is about the same impact weight as a cricket ball traveling at 22.5 miles per hour. But what has a head falling 2 to 3 feet got to do with anything? Well, I'm going to talk about the guillotine. Because, well, if you're going to have your head cut off, then this would be the ideal method, right? Wait, has anyone actually ever survived having their head cut off by a guillotine? Well, hear me out. As the title of this episode suggests, this episode is going to be an, strange one. But something I find kind of interesting. You see, I was recently reading a book about medieval torture methods, and after reading about the guillotine, it got me thinking. You know, when that blade cuts through your neck, do you actually die instantly? And if not, what's the alternative? Well, for those of you unaware, the guillotine was a killing device that made it easy work for chopping a person's head off. And like getting burned at the stake, crucified, condemned to the Iron Maiden, or hung, drawn and quartered, there was no torture element to beheadings. It consists of a tall frame with a heavy, angled blade that is raised and then dropped to sever the human head. The person condemned to death is secured with what is known as a pillory at the bottom of the frame, essentially securing the person face down or face up with their neck held firmly in position directly below the blade. The blade is then released and dropped 6 feet from the top of the vertical frame, swiftly and forcefully decapitating the condemned with a single, clean swipe of the blade. The severed head then falls into a basket below. The guillotine is perhaps most famously associated with executions during the French Revolution. Famously, Louis XVI of France, for example, and Marie Antoinette. Beheadings back in those days were considered to be the most humane form of execution. It was quick and effective, and seen as far more accurate than using an axe for beheadings, which was the norm before this invention. A barbaric time when an inaccurate swing by the axeman or a dull blade could really dampen the party. And when things went wrong, boy did they go wrong, with people losing the tops of their head and having their brains spill out while still alive, to individuals being hacked to death slowly with multiple chops and swings. Actually, it was customary in most of Europe in medieval times for the more wealthy individuals who were condemned to death by beheading to tip their executioner. An act to ensure the axeman guaranteed that the blade was sharp and his swing was accurate. The genius thing about the guillotine, when that came along, was that it put the blade at an angle. That way it relied more on slicing power rather than that of brute force. But the guillotine, which was primarily used for capital punishment in France, was actually used by the state right up until 1977. Hell, Star Wars was released before they stopped using this thing. The guillotine was also used for a period in Germany, where it was known as Fallbeil, or falling axe, or alternatively, and in later years, the Kampfmaschine, or beheading machine. It was used in Germany from the 19th century onwards and gained a resurgence under Hitler's Nazi regime. You see, Nazi Germany used the guillotine between 1933 and 1945 to execute over 16,500 prisoners. 10,000 of those were in the 12 months between 1944 and 45 alone. An execution of prominence was when the Nazi government guillotined Sophie Scholl, who was convicted of high treason after distributing anti-Nazi pamphlets at the University of Munich along with her brother Hans. To repeat, death by beheading for handing out leaflets. Standard Nazis. The guillotine was named after Joseph Ignace Guillotin, a French politician and doctor, but he was not the one who invented it. He merely advocated for its use as a mere humane method of execution rather than the existing practices of the time, back in 1789. Additionally, credit is often given to Antoine Louis, who designed the first prototype in 1791, which was then built by German engineer Tobias Schmidt for use in France for the first time in 1792. But this is also a falsehood. Those two also did not invent the guillotine. A much older device, by the name of the Halifax gibbet, was invented in England in around the year 1280. This was a precursor to the guillotine and was a wooden structure consisting of two wooden upright posts capped by a horizontal beam around 15 feet in height, or roughly 4.5 meters. An axe head weighing around 8 pounds was used as the blade, which was attached to the bottom of a wooden block that slid up and down in grooves in the upright posts. This device was widely used across England until 1650, when Oliver Cromwell outlawed it for use as capital punishment. A similar device was also created and used in Scotland between 1564 to 1710. Named the Maiden, the device was similar to the English version and invented by the Regent James Douglas, 4th Earl of Morton, who himself was executed by the Maiden in 1581. Morton was responsible for its introduction in Edinburgh, Scotland, and had based the concept on the Halifax gibbet. Both the Halifax gibbet and the Maiden would fall out of favour in Britain after Cromwell's banning of them, and they never returned. But in 1792, the guillotine, as it was now known, was first used to execute somebody in Paris, and it was quickly proclaimed to be the official form of capital punishment of France. It became hugely popular amongst the masses too. People really liked it. Everybody at the time agreed that it was the most humane way to execute someone, but it was also considered to be a symbol of equality, a real class divide breaker. Before the guillotine, a person from the rich class might get a quick, dignified death, whereas a person from the peasant class could wind up getting hanged in the street. But with a guillotine, all these things were considered equal. Royalty down to the lowliest street urchin all got their heads lopped off in the exact same way. And given how that's what the Reign of Terror during the French Revolution was all about, it makes perfect sense that it became so popular there. Side note, someone recently said to me when I was discussing putting this episode together,
"You know, that Queen Marie Antoinette was complete class personified, given her last words, wasn't she?"
Well, for clarity, when Antoinette was being led to the guillotine, she accidentally stepped on the foot of her executioner, to which she said to him, quote,
"Pardonnez-moi, monsieur, je ne l'ai pas fait exprès."
Or for those of you who are not fluent in French,
"Pardon me, sir, I did not do it on purpose."
You might think that Marie Antoinette would have other things on her mind. Pure class, that is, or so I'm told. Anyway, jumping back to those accomplished innovators in human suffering, the Nazis, during the Second World War, they would improve the centuries-old design of the guillotine and make it vastly more efficient, because of course they would. They modified it by shortening the span of the drop that the blade had to fall. And this essentially meant that they could churn victims through for the most maximum and efficient human carnage possible. Once again, standard Nazis. Now, as much as I know that you guys love a good history lesson, let's hop to the real reason that you came to this episode. How you can survive a beheading. Well, for as long as there has been beheadings, there has always been the question of whether or not you actually remain conscious after your head is removed from your body. Something named lucid decapitation. In fact, individuals within the crowds during the French Revolution who had watched the guillotine being used reported seeing heads blinking and changing facial expressions post-decapitation. So, at a time where doctors were beginning to gain a better understanding and idea of the physiology of the human body, and of course the circulatory system, they began to understand that consciousness would not just go away immediately. It would take some time for the blood to drain out of the brain and for the victim of the beheading to lose consciousness and die. But the question is, how long exactly would that take? After all, we were fairly certain that it would not be instantaneous. Well, there were stories that emerged from French prisons in the 1890s and 1900s of prisoners being asked to blink for as long as possible after their decapitation had taken place, just to see how long that would last for. There were some reports of that blinking going on for up to 30 seconds, but this wasn't scientifically measured or verified. Doctors and scientists who looked into this phenomenon didn't know for sure if those reports were of conscious facial movements that the beheaded person was doing, or just some kind of natural death spasm. But then along came a doctor named Dr. Barriot, who conducted one of the most well-documented cases there is on the subject. Barriot experimented with a condemned man named Henri Langlois. During Langlois' execution on June 28, 1905, the doctor recorded his results in his medical journal. I think it's best if I let the good doctor explain what happened during this experiment himself. These are the doctor's words, taken from his journal. Quote,
"I consider it essential for you to know that Langlois displayed an extraordinary sang-froid and even courage from the moment when he was told that his last hour had come, until the moment when he walked firmly to the scaffold. It may well be, in fact, that the conditions for observation and consequently the phenomena differ greatly according to whether the condemned persons retain all their sang-froid and are fully in control of themselves, or whether they are in such state of physical and mental prostration that they have to be carried to the place of execution and are already half dead and as though paralyzed by the appalling anguish of the fatal instant. The head fell severed on the hard surface, cut at the neck. I did not have to take it up in my hands, as all the newspapers have vied with each other in repeating. I was not obliged even to touch it in order to set it upright. Chance served me well for the observation which I wished to make. Here, then, is what I was able to note immediately after the decapitation. The eyelids and lips of the guillotined man worked in irregularly rhythmic contractions for about 5 or 6 seconds. This phenomenon has been remarked by all those finding themselves in the same conditions as myself for observing what happens after the severing of the neck. I waited for several seconds. The spasmodic movements ceased. The face relaxed, the lids half closed over the eyeballs, leaving only the white of the conjunctiva visible, exactly as in the dying, whom we have occasion to see every day in the exercise of our profession, or as in those just dead. It was then that I called in a strong, sharp voice, Languille. I saw his eyelids slowly lift up without any spasmodic contractions. I insist advisedly on this peculiarity, but with an even movement, quite distinct and normal, such as happens in everyday life, with people awakened or torn from their thoughts. Next, Languille's eyes very definitely fixed themselves on mine, and the pupils focused themselves. I was not then dealing with the sort of vague, dull look, without any expression, that can be observed any day in dying people to whom one speaks. I was dealing with undeniably living eyes which were looking at me. After several seconds, the eyelids closed again, slowly and evenly, and the head took on the same appearance as it had had before I called out. It was at that point that I called out once again, Languille. Then once more, without any spasm, slowly the eyelids lifted and undeniably living eyes fixed themselves on mine, with perhaps even more penetration than the first time. Then there was a further closing of the eyelids, but now less complete. I attempted the effect with a third call, but there was no further movement. The eyes took on the glazed look which they have in the dead. I have just recounted to you with rigorous exactness what I was able to observe. The whole thing had lasted for 35 seconds.
So there you have it, by all accounts. When you were beheaded, it appears that you remain conscious for around 35 seconds. After the blade falls and cuts through your neck, that cold metal cutting through like a hot knife through butter, the ground will rush up towards you. You will likely feel the impact of your head hitting the ground or basket below. When you hit the floor, you'll hit it with the force of a medium-bowled cricket ball, landing either on your forehead, nose or chin if you are beheaded face down, or the back of your head if you are laying face up, though I would imagine that to be worse, watching the blade rush down towards you. Hopefully, for your sake, the slice will be clean, at which point blood will fill your nasal cavities, but you won't be able to blow it out. You'll be in a state of shock as the world spins around, but you will be lucid and conscious. When your head comes to its rest, there will be blood pouring out through your ears, but you won't feel it. You won't be able to breathe, but you also won't be fighting for breath, as your lungs are now detached from your spinal cord. Then your head will sit there waiting. You might focus and look at what's in front of you, but you won't be able to move your eyes. You might choose to close your eyes and await your finality. As the tunnel vision sets in and the light slowly go out, your brain will begin to shut down throughout the outside of the cortex. First, it will shut down the sensory and motor cortex, which will give you a feeling that you're not in your body anymore. The last cortex that shuts down is your memory cortex, and this is why people who have had near-death experiences often get the feeling of going through a tunnel and seeing their lives flash before their eyes. So for the most part, death is less like falling asleep, more like a quick journey through your entire life, likely feeling that it takes longer than it actually does. All before you get to your very last memory, where everything shuts down completely and you expire. Dr. Marcel Petiot was a French medical doctor and serial killer. He was found guilty of the murders of 23 Jews and burying them in the basement of his house in Paris during the Second World War. Petiot was subsequently sentenced to death by guillotine and was executed on this day in 1946. His last words before the blade dropped were, quote,
Messieurs, j'ai un conseil à vous donner. Faites demi-tour, car ce ne sera pas un spectacle agréable.
Or, once again in English,
Gentlemen, I have some advice for you. Turn your back, because this will not be a pleasant sight.
I think Petiot was likely right, at least about that anyway. But for all intents and purposes, if you can help it, don't get your head cut off, because the last thing you will feel will be pain as your head hits the ground. And depending where it falls, the last thing you will see might be the cold, hard floor, someone's shoes, or your executioner's staring back at you. But wait. So what are the chances, post-beheading, of your head being stitched back on? Is that even possible? Well, medically, there are three technical challenges that would face a surgeon if they attempted to do just this. As with any organ transplant, managing the immune system response to avoid transplant rejection is key. Also, the brain is highly dependent on continuous blood flow to provide oxygen to the brain, so your window of opportunity would be very short. Finally, managing the nervous system in both the body and the head would be imperative. The automatic nervous system controls essential functions like breathing and the heart beating, and is governed by the brainstem. So, if the recipient body's head is removed, well, this can no longer function. Additionally, each nerve coming out of the head via the spinal cord will need to be reattached to the correct corresponding nerves in the body's spinal column, so that the brain can recontrol movement and receive sensory information. Whilst two of these three jobs are fairly routine in current medicine, the spinal cord and nervous system connections are a considerable issue currently. This challenge to reconnect the central nervous system is only in the very early stages at the time of publishing this episode. All this aside, you would also have to do this within the 35-second window before the brain life shuts down. Or, you would need to immediately freeze the head and preserve it medically, which isn't impossible. Doctors, such as Italian neurosurgeon Sergio Canavero, who have been researching this very subject since 2013, believes that this entire operation will be entirely possible in the very near future. But, by current estimation, it would take around 36 hours to complete the operation and more than 100 medical staff to assist. Just imagine regaining consciousness and looking down to find a new and different body. Thank you for listening tonight, guys. A somewhat dark and morbid subject, but an interesting one nevertheless, I think. I suppose if nothing else, it gives you some kind of idea of how our brain works. So, one last thing here tonight. If you're not a Dead Souls Patreon member, you can join our morbid little club of supporters for just $2, and you can get access to all kinds of cool perks, such as exclusive episodes, blog articles, research and more. We're also going to be releasing some limited edition merch on there soon too, so watch out for that. Just go over to www.patreon.com/deadsouls. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.